How do you pronounce your name?
Okay, my name is Jennifer Nansubuga Makumbi.
I ask you to pick a song that captures your writing journey of the first woman / a woman is a body of water.
The song I chose is Wale Wale by Chameleon. But all those stories are actually actual stories that I picked from my oral tradition, because it's talking about Mwenkanonkano, the indigenous feminist thought. Our mothers, they wrote all these ideas in folk tales, but they coded them. And now what I am doing is decoding.
Welcome to Books and Rhymes, the podcast that celebrates the joy of reading by flipping the script with a musical twist on your favorite books. I invite guests to pair books with songs or albums that spark the same emotional connection. I'm your host, Sarah, a West African in the diaspora with a deep abiding love for the written word. Join me as I take you on a musical journey through the works of new and classic authors. In today's episode, we conclude our two-part conversation with Jennifer Nansubuga Makumbi, the critically acclaimed author of two novels and a collection of short stories, whose recent novel, The First Woman, is published in the USA as A Girl is a Body of Water. We discuss the significance of Labi Sifre's song Something Inside So Strong in Makumbi's migration experience and her treatment of indigenous feminism in relation to Western feminism in her latest novel, The First Woman, and the parallels between Chintu and Things Fall Apart. Subscribe, rate and review Books and Rhymes, the podcast, on Apple Podcasts and all podcast listening platforms.
I ask you to pick a song that captures your writing journey of The First Woman / A Woman is a Body of Water, which is your recently published book, which I read and I just love. Oh my goodness. And I can't wait for you to talk about it.
Oh God, thank you for asking for that. And the song I chose is Wale Wale by Chameleon. Now, that is a Ugandan musician. Again, there are times when I just go Ugandan. Get on the computer, get on YouTube, and I go Chameleon all day long, just going through his music and just dancing away like mad. But the reason I chose this song is that, you know, it starts with a trumpet, and the trumpet is so Western looking. Yeah. However, all through, and when you see the video, this boy, he's dressed very Western, very aware of the new fashion, you know. And he's like trumpeting to the world, I'm coming, I'm arriving. But all throughout the song, he's just looking back to Africa, to what he's leaving behind, or to the rural village, or if he's going to the city.
Show me the way, show me every possibility. Others got plenty, others no opportunity. Show me the way, how to live out a calamity. Show me the way.
But it reminded me of my departure from Africa. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to the West and I'm going to write. And I've been writing Uganda. It's like I never left. I'm like, what is going on here? And when I was listening to it, you know, I noticed that the colors that in the video are so similar to the color of the first woman. I thought, did she know? Honestly, I recommend that you watch the video. But Chameleon, the Uglish is another thing. He sings in English. Part of it is in English, but it's Ugandan English. And part of it is Swahili, which is very East African. Mm. And of course, part of it is Uganda, which it's like, you know, it's that thing of Ugandans that, you know, I'm going to share this song with the world, but there's a little bit for you Ugandans, just to take you a little bit further, you know, so that you listen to and you say, yes, brother, I get you. I know what you're saying. And it's mainly saying, you know, do whatever you do, but don't hold back. Just give it your all.
There's one thing I noted with the first woman / a woman is a body of water. But before we start talking about it, why do Americans insist on publishing your book on a different title, please? I know it's like I'm accusing you, like, please, why?
Yeah. Do you know how much I've been defending? Everywhere I go, I'm defending the American title. First of all, it's a fantastic title that speaks to a certain aspect of the novel. Yes. But the reason that the Americans could not publish it under The First Woman is that they've had a lot of books, and the whole idea of The First Woman is very prevalent. You know, like The First Woman in Space, now The First Woman President Indeed, or Ginsburg. You know, they thought that in that title, Americans would look at it and they would go in a very different direction. And because Chintu was not as successful out there as it was in
the UK and outside.
Now in the UK, people are aware that Chintu is the first man. The titles are speaking to each other. But in the US, it didn't work like that. So had I been well known, because now Chintu is being read more there now than it was before, because people are discovering it through The First Woman. If it had been that successful before, then it would have made sense that you can say that these books are in conversation. So that is why. Let's tell the story properly. I wasn't so happy about that, because there had been another book by the Commonwealth which had been my title. But I think because my earlier publisher was very tiny, they thought that they could use the title of an award-winning short story to promote it.
I imagine that when you're writing a book, you would have certain titles swirling through your head.
Yes.
Because the title, in like writing essays, the title tells you what you're doing. It gives you a focus, a vision, a direction.
Yeah, it's where I record what I want to do.
Mm.
So I always go back to the title and it reminds me, that's what you're doing. This is what you're doing.
Which were the titles that you attributed to the books when you were writing them? And did the titles make it? Were they published under those titles? And if yes, how do you then reconcile writing towards this title and then having the title renamed, like having your child renamed? How do you reconcile that?
So what happens is that, so I wrote under The First Woman. Yeah, so that's what I wrote under. And I wrote under Manchester Happened. But the titles are changed even sometimes after editing. So I don't write to the title. The title then must relate itself, make itself comfortable in the book. So nothing is changed, really. So Americans love A Girl is a Body of Water. You know, they also wonder how the first woman, the first thing I was told, this title wins the award of a title, you know. And I've also met Africans who say, oh, I like the American title better. So I'm very okay, comfortable. What I'm not comfortable with are Africans who are ordering both books.
Like I told you, cover ho, book ho, speaking to you right now, except I bougified by HEAUX, you know what I mean? Do you know how many books I have with different titles? I bought a book by, I think it was Gwendolyn by Buchi Emetita.
Ah.
I bought the American edition of the book without realizing it. I have Gwendolyn and I also have The Family, which is the American title of the book. Ugly cover, but that's a different story. I didn't realize I was buying two titles of the same book. With Dinah McGinsty, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, published in America as Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, but in the UK as Children of the Revolution. Both titles, so Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears is derived from a line in Dante's Inferno. And it's like derived from, I think, the last line in the book. And then Children of the Revolution is derived from the popular song, Children of the Revolution. And the song is referenced, both the song is referenced in the book and the Dante's quote is referenced in the book because protagonist is like a Dante fan. But if you don't know, you buy two copies of the same book without realizing it.
Absolutely. And for me, it was because the books already are very expensive to Africans. So someone ordering two books, you know, and so I went through a situation where I was, oh my God, Africans are going to order. But then I just made sure that the people who are talking about it would write both the titles. And I was so glad that you're using both titles.
So going into the analysis of The First Woman, you employed many devices in The First Woman. At the beginning, we are introduced to our protagonists. How is her name pronounced again, please?
Again, it's like Chinto, Chirabo.
K is Ch, Chirabo.
K-I. So you know the musician Chiwanuka?
Yeah. Oh!
He's not Kiwanuka.
And the B is quite silent.
Very. Yeah, that's why our country is Uganda. It's supposed to be Buganda, but the British couldn't hear the B. It's already, the B is silent.
You've mentioned her first encounter with Ntate.
Mm-hmm.
The way you wrote the story, the literary devices that you use, I enjoyed how you wove storytelling, mythology into the narrative structure. And you did this through the character of
Nsuta.
You did it through the character of Nsuta. Chirabo is on a quest for something, and she goes to Ntuta for the answer to it. This elusive secret that nobody wants to tell her.
Yeah.
And then in a way, sort of like giving a child candy, she gives her stories, but not just any stories, stories of the matriarchs. Not just any matriarchs, the mythological matriarchs, not just any mythological matriarchs, but didactic mythological matriarchs, not just but feminist didactic mythological matriarchs.
Yes.
Before even then, Chirabo is a storyteller. She loves stories. So we're introduced to her as a storyteller. I made a note that in Chintu, you showed us, right? And the same with The First Woman.
Mm-hmm.
We witnessed, we experienced, we felt these characters because you showed them to us. But in The First Woman, a character is telling us.
Yeah.
So where writers are advised to show, don't tell, you told.
Yes.
And you showed.
Yes.
Talk to us about that decision, please.
Oh, God. Now, because I have a 12-year-old narrator, she is not capable of understanding everything that is going on around her. Okay. And also those stories, they are operating at two levels. The stories are operating at her level as a child, but they are operating as very, very mature stories. Okay. And so I wanted to tell them from Chirabo's point of view. And I was going to trust you, the readers, to interpret those stories. Because these two people, Nsuta is telling the stories from a grown-up point of view. Chirabo is understanding them from a child point of view. And you, the reader, are in the middle there. Yeah, you are supposed to understand those stories from an adult point of view. So, for example, I'll tell you, remember the story about the Lukokowe? They say the woman who steps out, the old woman, and then a young boy, a young lad, swapping yard comes along. Exactly. So Chilabo tells this story with a very straight face. It's about a horrible old woman. Auntie Nsuta says, she's a widow. And she's like, she's a widow, but you know, that's what happens when young old men marry virgins, which means, you know, she's a widow because perhaps she married at 14 to an old man who was 40. So the man has died. Mm. So she's not an old woman. But Chirabo does not know at all what is going on. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And later she called her stepmother, Lukokowe, absolutely having no idea what that book. I mean, yes, it's a feminist story that is talking about how women sexuality was controlled
mm-hmm.
at the time, but she hadn't connected the sexual element to the story, so she applies it. You, the reader, are supposed to see that this is a story that talks about women's sex. So when this woman, a young man, comes along and says, can you carry me? Okay. And she jumps on his back, locks the hands and whatever. And then he goes walking around in circles all night. This is the idea that women at a certain age in their 40s, that they are sexually insatiable. The idea that women's libido is just, it goes round. It's not libidinous. It's not linear, you know, from beginning to huddling to the end of release, that it goes around in circles and returns in circles. So Chilabo is telling this story.
It's sort of like, it reminds me of the European, that sort of nymphomaniac. Good sexual appetite is demonized.
Yeah, it's these days they're called cougars.
Oh.
Yes.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And this woman is preparing her and telling her, look, all these stories are about the control of women. You know, that she's saying to her, you love the folktale, but the folktale is not your friend. All the folktale is about control of women as stepmothers, girls as ugly stepsisters, girls as clever, rather intelligent, very beautiful and proud, you know, and therefore they marry all girls who eat them. You know, it's all about the control of women, you know. But yeah, Chilabo at that point was not ready to understand, but Nsuta has no option. This child is going to be taken away from her. you know. And so she hopes that she has given her enough that she would look back to and say, oh yeah, and Suta told me. Oh yeah, now it makes sense. But I use that because then you, the reader, you work out all of that. Between Nsuta and Chirabo, Nsuta is speaking as an old woman, Chirabo is speaking as a child, but you, the reader, is supposed to see it from Nsuta's point of view. So this is why I tell. Because this story is not saying what is. It's the same story that Chirabo tells. It's the same with the story that Chirabo tells at the beginning. Chirabo is telling her story. That is her story, but she has no idea. And for the reader, it's until you get to the end that you look back and you say, oh. But all those stories are actually actual stories that I picked from my oral tradition. And yes, and they are telling these stories because I am talking to Ugandans and saying, look back to these stories. Our ancestors, we know, because it's talking about Mwenkanonkano, the indigenous feminist thought. And I am saying to Ugandans that, you know what? Our mothers recorded their feminist thought in these stories. You go back. Because women, as we said before, they held the heavy words under their tongues, that they bit their tongues before, they could not articulate. They wrote all these ideas in folk tales, but they coded them. And now what I am doing is decoding. So, but I'm not going to decode it for you. I put it in the story and you decode.
But then I think that what you're doing is you are giving, whilst to me, yes, you are decoding the story, but I think you are giving the reader the key to decode the story. Because if I'm going to follow your assertion that you are decoding the story, then to me, it seems like there's a double decoding going on, because you told multiple folk tales,
yes,
in the book, but these folk tales then go on to feature in other aspects of the story. Absolutely. Along the line, so there are Absolutely. Characters who then become embodiments,
yes,
of these folk tales. And the thing is that Ntate does not explain all the stories to Chirabo explicitly.
Yes.
Like, as you alluded, Ntate is concerned that Chirabo is going to move away. And yes, she's preparing her for the violence world of patriarchy. Because yes, that she's saying that, and it's said explicitly in the book. Patriarchy is mentioned explicitly in the beginning, within, in the context of Ntate educating, yes, because that's what's going on here.
Go in on. Case it comes, her name is Nsuta.
And so I'm like Ntate. Ntate is like the love, the guy who fancies her.
That is true. And I, because I knew that my readers trust me, I know that anybody who read Chintu and understood it would come to this book and say, yeah, I know she is going to come through for me. So if you have not interpreted the stories the way I hope you have decoded, then you're going to see Chirabo either make a mess of them, and then you will start to realize, oh, she starts to leave them, or she starts to understand them and say, oh, okay, this is what Nsuta talked about. So you are working with Chirabo. So this is why when you read it, you're like, you are telling. Yes, I'm telling, but sweetheart, you're working harder.
It's like, I'm telling you so you know.
Yeah, yeah.
The path you're about to walk on.
Yeah, absolutely. So, because I know as you get to parts like when she's in boarding school, you're going to start looking back and say, huh, what did Suta say about this?
I wasn't ready for the boarding school bit. There are so many climaxes in The First Woman. The fire for fire. And I like that you mentioned the Moen Kano Kano, because that was that's a recurring phrase throughout the book.
Yes.
Moen Kano Kano. And I noted one in particular. I find it interesting how Sio is positioned within the framework of yes. patriarchy and feminism.
Yes.
How, at the beginning, I mean, I felt a physical shift in my heart at his, that sort of, oh, I'm not going to say anything, but oh, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm feeling something. What is this? What is this emotion I'm feeling? And then there was a conversation between him and Chirabo, and where he said, this is page 219, and he says, as I said before, I believe in Moen Kano Kano. It is wrong to disfigure.
Yeah.
He is stating, and this is him like pitching, laying his flag, like, boom, this is where I stand.
Yes.
And then it's one thing to say it. It is another thing to do it and to live it.
Yeah.
And so this is to me about the gray lines that you paint with your characters.
Yes.
You sort of play with morality a lot with your work.
Yes.
There's a play on morality here. There's a play on trust. Who do you trust in this universe?
Yeah.
It also speaks to you, the reader, as well. How much birth do you give people to be human?
Yeah.
In not just a character's behavior, but a character's response to another character's behavior that affects them.
Yes.
So there's a lot of conflict that takes place in The First Woman. There are some conflict that are exposed at the beginning. And there are some conflicts that friendships that become conflicted.
Yes.
There's a lot of untrustworthiness and there is a lot of hypocrisy as well. Hypocrisy in Sio saying that, you know, laying his flag as a Moen Kano Kano. And then so British, Moen Kano Kano, like that's what you said. Oh, Jesus. You know?
Just remember me saying Okonkwo.
Our names have suffered. So, like I said about this sort of hypocrisy, then you have Abby.
Yes.
Her auntie / mother and the mothering. I like the fluidity of mothering in your work and in the universe of your work. And you do explain it in the novel as well. So we're not going to go into that. You do explain the significance of mothering and why mothering takes on different forms. But Abby is a character who, once again, we're introduced to her as this, bam.
Yeah.
Moen Kano Kano. But then you ask yourself, are you really?
Especially where Sio is concerned.
Are you really? It reminds me, when you're talking about Nsuta preparing Chirabo for the world, there is a parting word she tells her. Remember when you meet other women. Remember.
Yeah.
Be mindful of your treatment of other women, even if, and I'm paraphrasing, even if they behave in a bad way towards you, there is always a reason behind that.
Yeah.
And I feel that to you.
We react, we don't act.
Yes. I feel that is you slipping a message in there for the reader. Remember these women whom you're going to encounter in the book.
Yeah. Here's the thing. In Sota is saying that when you Moen Kano Kano as a theory, we have to look at women and how we relate to each other under oppression. Okay, because under oppression, we can't fight back at the patriarchy. Often we can't fight back at the men who are using the patriarchy to step down on us. But of course, they are bearing down on us and there's pressure. And that pressure must be, you know, expanded. You know, you must release it. So either you turn against yourself and harm your body, which you call self-harm, or we harm each other. Okay, so we already, and often we say, oh, women are terrible to women. but we don't realize why. Because I'll give you an example. There was when, and I'm sorry to bring this name into this sacred discussion, but when Trump was...
I knew that was a name.
It just kills everything. Some people just give him a nickname, but I'll call him by his name. When he was campaigning against Clinton, okay, and they got that vile tape about him. Now, when he was having that, it was the debate with Hillary, he brought four women that accused Bill Clinton of whatever and sat them in front of Hillary. And these women agreed. Hillary had never done anything to them.
Mm.
On the contrary, Bill had cheated on Hillary. But here was a man who had been accused by 12 women
mm-hmm.
of sexually assaulting them, using four women to come and attack a wife. Not attack, it was to intimidate.
Mm.
And the women agreed. Under what circumstances, tell me, sister, under what circumstances do you do that to a fellow woman? For that kind of man? I thought that that was the ugliest thing I'd ever seen in public. But he was aware that we women, we don't fight people like him. We prefer to fight each other. And those women just sat there silently and glared. They did not talk, they just glared at Hillary. That is what Mwenkanonkano tells you, that remember that that woman you're doing that to is also under pain. And remember that Nsutta told her that one day you'll catch your man cheating with another woman. And you won't go for your man, you'll go for the fellow, for the woman who didn't even know about you often. But even if she knew you, she doesn't owe you anything. It's the man who owes you everything. Western feminism left all these gray areas. And this is sometimes, you know, then because that such a space has not been handed, then women can turn around and say, oh, but you're talking about men, but we women are terrible to each other. Or men will say, oh, but women are horrible to each other and play us against them. So Nsutta is a traditional, an indigenous feminist. Yeah. And she's rejecting Western feminism. And she is preparing this girl for feminism that comes from her ancestors. Okay. And so this is why she says, remember, women react, they don't act, you know. But Chirabo is taking some time to work it out.
Yeah, in the same way we are also working it out on the journey of the novel.
You know what, I am, that whole idea of Mwenkanonkano was something that I was doing in my PhD thesis. And it was rejected. So now I put, I know. Let's not even go there.
But no, I'm like, yes, you're inserting, you're doing your work that you really wanted to do in a way that we get to read it and we're appreciating it.
Yeah, absolutely. So now I'm going to go back to the chapter I was writing because I only wrote a little bit in the novel. So now I'm going to develop the whole chapter and I hope to give the paper in Uganda, which is fantastic because now the whole idea of Mwenkanonkano, it's not theory written in a Western university and kept there. It's something that a Ugandan 15-year-old girl would turn around and say, I know what Jennifer is saying, but Do you know? Because she owns it.
Mm.
Not the way we read other thoughts written in such language that is inaccessible. You know, this is so accessible. And I would like Ugandans to go back to our mythologies and see what else is coded there.
Mm.
Wait. Chirabos' grandmother.
Yes.
You didn't dedicate a song to Alixa?
No, I thought about it.
Why? I feel betrayed on her behalf. Oh, no, I am betrayed.
I don't know. Let me see. Where would grandmother go? Where would grandmother go to find her music? And I think I would have to go for a Luganda song. I think she would go to Luganda. She's such a conformist.
That's the question I was going to ask, because you're speaking of Moin Kano Kano. Moin Kano Kano being quite, it is on its own, but it's also in the framework of the landscape of the first woman. It is also radical. And it's resistance.
Yeah, it is.
To the norm and status quo. Even though it is everyday normalized, it is also resistance.
Yeah, it is resistance. First of all, it's resistance to Western feminism. There's that resistance.
Yes.
But it is indigenous feminism, which, of course, is resistant to the patriarchy.
The conversation between Western feminism and Moin Kano Kano. Moin Kano Kano.
Yes.
You use a friendship to identify this conflict.
Yes.
And tension.
Yes.
Between that. So you have Alicia Muka Miro, our protagonist, Chirabo's grandmother. Yes. And then you have Unsuta.
Yes.
Our protagonist's other grandmother. You know?
Yes.
In the same way, Moin Kano Kano and Western feminism, in the same way that they are working towards the same a cause of women's liberation.
I like where you're going, sister. I like where you're going with it. I've never seen that. That is fantastic.
Same cause.
Yes.
Different approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So yes, I had never seen that. So there's Alixa Mkamiro. She wants the best for Chirabo. And there's Nsuta, but she wants the best for Chirabo. You know, they're both bringing her up. You know, Nsuta wants to bring her up to rebel. Grandmother wants to bring her up to conform, because life is very hard for a woman. They're both working. And you know, now that you're saying it, because now I remember grandmother saying to Nsuta, if we listened to what Nsuta says, she lives in the clouds, you know. The world would grind to a stop. You know, that is Mkamiro, but Nsuta is like, no. I know there's a rebellious child in you, that child that flies out, and I am going to prepare her. I am going to prepare her for the world, you know. But at the same time, we have Western feminism, which comes, Chirabo sees it through the conference, the 1975 Women's Conference
in
Mexico. And she hears it. And Nsuta is also listening, you know. But Nsuta is thinking, no, this is not going to work for us. This is just not going to work for us. So she just prepares Chirabo for it. And Chirabo meets it a little bit again when Sio, because Sio is packaged. His father has done a fantastic job with him. You know, and he is so sure, He even is prepared to teach Jill about feminism. There are certain men, you know, God help us. And so those feminisms are also want the best for every woman, okay? But they're doing it differently. And I, you know, I had not noticed that, but thank you for pointing it out. The parallel between the mothers, rather the grandmothers, and the feminisms.
So this battleground is taking place in the heart and mind and the future trajectory of the young person.
Yes, indeed.
And in a, it's another thing, another exposition in the text, that you're watching how these ancestry, this feminist ancestry that Tirabo is inheriting, that she is being inculcated with, how this plays out in how she navigates the world.
Indeed, but also, it also shows you that African feminism goes so far. In the book, it goes back to Nsuta's grandmothers. It goes, Nsuta didn't start this. It is her grandmothers who were living in abduction.
Yeah.
Who told her these stories, how our children started to belong to their fathers, even though they grow in our stomachs. That's, you know, Nsuta was such a child when she was told these stories, you know? But as she's growing older and she gets educated and she thinks about it and she goes through life as education, she builds up on it. And then when she feels that, you know, she's getting weaker, she passes it on to Chilabo. She tells Chilabo, you know what? I want you to take this. I don't know in which shape it's going to be, but you must take it forward. And so that is Mwenkanonkano. It's not a movement. It doesn't have manifestos. They've not been theorists. They've not been movements or demonstrating in the streets. But it's there. It's very local. It's very private. It's very everyday. Okay? But so, and that's the thing with feminism. It is life. Every woman fights. But most women look at it as life. They push, and then sometimes they retreat. They negotiate. They cajole. You know, they compromise. And then they push again forward. You know, this is how feminism has been working in Africa, but we haven't talked about it that way.
We will now. we are now. I asked you to pick a song that conveys the narrative landscape of the first woman / a girl is a body of water. I see you're excited.
The song that represents or reflects the narrative landscape of the first woman, a girl is a body of water, is Nikombag's Sweet Mother. But like, I did not have to choose this. Chirabo is listening to this song as she's traveling to school.
Yeah.
What I love about it is that it's the irony. Chirabo's mother is so much in her mind. Chirabo's mother is very fictitious. And she feeds on that song. You know? But there are bits of it that say, yeah. Bits of it that say, yeah. When I day cry, my mother go cry, go carry me. She go say, no, my bikini waiting.
You day cry, yo, yo.
Stop.
Bow. You know?
My mother go bed me. She go lie me well, well for bed. She cover me cloth, say make you sleep. Sleep me, my bikini.
This is such a very romanticized mother. you know? And Chinobo is waiting for this mother. And so as she travels in the car and she thinks about her mother and she thinks, okay, my mother could be a teacher in the school where I'm going. Oh, maybe her sister is a teacher in the school I'm going. Or maybe she has a sister as a student in the school. I might find her there. But she has been creating this mother, and we see her, sometimes we see her legs as she's falling asleep, and those legs are walking towards Chirabo, and then they are blown away. And then she has an afro like Diana Ross.
I like the breadcrumb you gave us when, like you said, Chirabo is obsessed with finding her mother, but she doesn't know anything about her mother. So she has to construct an image in her mind. Yeah. But then at the school, you gave us a breadcrumb. And I was like, oh. And she was like, oh.
Yeah.
And I said, wow. And I was like, oh.
And then you look back in the book and you're like,
oh. And then you get to the end, you're like, oh. It's like, no words, just sounds, oh, ooh, wow.
Look, Sarah, when I was growing up, it's those authors that drove me crazy. You know, they dangle some little thing.
Why are you torturing me? All I wanted was, I'm paying you to torture me. Why?
This, I paid for this book. Why am I putting myself through this? You know, just let me know. But and that was the pleasure of reading for me, you know. And so, yeah, I do feel like wicked.
Huh.
When I'm throwing those crumbs around. And, I threw some crumbs in the earlier book. And they were right there in your face. I didn't even hide them. And I'm like, they're going to walk past these. And they're going to walk past that. And they're going, because Chinobo is walking past them as well.
You mentioned you threw breadcrumb in the first book, Chintu.
Yes.
You see my face. Can I just tell you that, while I thank you for the journey you took me on, I did not appreciate the emotional journey I went on. I didn't. I felt like I was going through a ringer, not just emotional, psychological, because Chintu to me is a very psychological book.
It is.
People call it, yes, this, you give us a psychological tale through historical fiction. I feel like you're doing one thing. You're using historical fiction to tell us to delve into the mind.
Yes.
The theme of mental well-being and mental illness.
Yes.
Features a lot.
Yes.
And you do this in different ways. There's a character who you're concerned about if this character is going to self-harm.
Yes.
Because there's a dual personality going on there.
Yes.
You start Chintu with a foundation. In the same way Chintu is mentioned in The First Woman, you're going back to the first. Like you said, there's a conversation taking place between both books, right? Yes. So you start in Chintu, we know that there are two women and these women are tied to each other. We know something happened in Chintu, with the generation is cursed, but it is how this duality of this women's relationship mutates over time and manifests in future generation. I couldn't help seeing that connecting thread of this book finished, but the spirit continues.
Indeed. You know what? I was told that's what made it a feminist novel, because though Chintu is the first man on earth, when you come to the end, it's the women that have been recurring and recurring and recurring.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
But the reveal at the end, though, I said, what is going on? I mean, there is, I said, what?
I know. Look, I do what other authors have done to me. Look, and look, here's my philosophy. For people who love football, okay, the pleasure of football is both the losses and the wins. Yeah. At the end of the season, when they look back, it's both the pain and the glory that makes that complete thing. And so it's the same with the book. Yes, you're going to cry. Yes, parts of it are going to hurt.
Now you tell us.
You know, there are moments sometimes I'm reading a book and I put it down and I'm restless because I immerse myself in books like that. And I'm so restless and I'm so restless and I'm not going to touch that book again. I'm not going to read again. But then I can't keep away.
Does your brain get hot? Because my brain gets hot when I'm just like, I need to calm, please, ice, oh yeah, calm, please, tempo, ice, calm down.
Oh. You know, let me tell you something. There's one part of Jean 2 that I wrote once. I couldn't bear to go back to it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Pray tell.
The tragedy.
Okay. Let's talk about that tragedy. Did you know, like the tragedy at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you know that there is a direct parallel between your writing of the Chintu, that the pre-tragedy?
Yeah.
Chintu and the two sons and the family structure.
Yeah.
There's a direct parallel with that and things fall apart. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
Well. I realized when I had finished writing it. And I thought, okay, what is going on here? What is going on here? And then I just locked it out. But yes, I can see there are two brothers, Ikemefuna and Nwoye.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Nwoye, who went on to become Obi's father in No Longer at Ease.
Yeah. But as I told you, when I said, and this is bizarre, because when I told you that I can put a book down and be restless, the one thing that I put a book down upon was Ikemefuna running to her, to his father. And I put the book down and I went some and I said, what is wrong with African writers? Because I was pretty young. Why don't they write happy books?
Same!
Why would they do this to me?
And then full circle.
You know, and I remember my dad coming home and I followed him around. I remember following him around. Would he do this to me? Could he? And I remember for the first time, I noticed that my dad had very long, slender fingers. That is how much I was affected. But I went back to the book. So when I tell you that I'm doing things that have been done to me by authors, I know what I'm talking about. So when you mention things fall apart, and when I've just told you that I put down books,
it's like, get out of here.
How did you know?
Because you did the same thing to us. Thank you.
Yeah, that is the connection. So I took my pain of Ikemefuna and I said, ha, now is my chance to inflict it on somebody else.
Oh my goodness. We've talked about Chintu. We've talked about The First Woman. Great novels. And then you bless us with a collection of short story in between.
Yes.
Both novels published as Manchester Happened in the UK and Let's Tell This Story Properly in America, which you alluded to earlier. So I asked you a very direct question. I said, if the characters in Manchester Happened / Let's Tell This Story Properly could express the Ugandan migrant experience in Britain to their predecessors in Chintu and The First Woman, which song would they choose and what would they say to them?
The song, again, this song is so similar to The Lion Sleeps Tonight. It's so obvious because it's a title of a short story.
Yeah.
In Manchester Happened, you know, something inside so strong. Nabi Sifre.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong.
Because this is a song that was written by a son of immigrants from Nigeria, okay? This song, I am telling you, it articulates every bit of my immigration experience. This is the song that I believe should be the theme song for Black Lives Matter. This is the song that perhaps could have been the song I would say yes to all those questions you've asked me before. Oh, my days. This is the song, once I heard him sing it, I was like, why on earth did you allow? Who was he who sang it again?
Labi Sifre.
No, the guy, the American country singer. How he took it in a very different direction in terms of messaging. So when you hear him sing it first, you don't realize what Labi was doing. Oh, I got so angry with
Kenny Rogers. Kenny Rogers.
Yes, it is Kenny Rogers. I would rather have people print out the lyrics and read them. And read the lyrics without the music. And here, this guy is a poet. It is so beautiful. But also there's that African cry. Well, Wait. It says exactly what you feel, but it's so, so promising. So, listen to this. The higher you build your barriers, I know, the taller I become. Yeah. The further you take my rights away, the faster I run. There's a part, you know, when I told you about the PhD, when I was told that I couldn't do the PhD, and which I later turned into part of it in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking to myself, he said, brothers and sisters, when they insist we are just not good enough, well, we know better. Just look them in the eye and say, we're going to do it anyway. We're going to do it anyway. And we're going to do it anyway. So I don't know. It's that song that says it better than you would have done if you wrote a novel. It just leaves you speechless. I couldn't wait to share it with the world. That just sticked to Labby's version, because he wrote this song.
That's the version on the playlist.
Yeah. I just listen to what he says. Oh God, you hide behind the walls of Jericho. It just brings tears to my eyes. I get so emotional about this song. It is everything I tried to do in that collection. And it was always there. I was always listening to it. I had included some lyrics and then I would remove them and then include them again and say, Jennifer, no, you can't steal someone's creativity and make it your own. Go write a better story. Just use the title. At one point I wanted to call the whole collection Something Inside So Strong, but I thought, no, that is someone's title. Oh God. People listen to writers and poets and they realize they marvel on how creative and intelligent, but man, this man is out there on his own. Because this, I don't remember when this song came out, but it's speaking to our time right now. And it was used apparently in South Africa against apartheid, you know? So it's a hardworking song. And my grandchildren, who may be out here in the West, this song will still be speaking to them. And so I want to thank Labby Siffre. I want to thank him for this song. It has kept me going for days. And thank you for asking, giving me a chance to talk about him.
Thank you for... Sincerely, thank you. Forever immortalized in my heart you are, because I came to the conversation like, yeah! And now it's like, oh my goodness, I met the queen and she's just as queenly and lovely and just, listen, I can't wait for my friends to be jealous of me when this episode goes out. I've got all the brownie points in the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking.
Because you've spoken so expansively about the song,
mm-hmm.
can you contextualize the book in relation to the song? For people who haven't read your short story collection or who have only been introduced to you through your short story collection, and also given that Manchester Happened is based in the present.
Yeah, yeah.
And your two novels are based in the past. The First Woman begins in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
How does Manchester Happen speak to both novels? How do they speak to each other in the context of Ugandan migrant experience in the UK? Because that is the subject matter to me. That's like the main theme of this short story collection.
All my characters, whether in the short stories or in the novel, they are fighting against something. There's something that they want to acquire. Okay. Chirabo, yes, she's looking for her mother, but she's looking for that equality, that elusive equality that her grandmothers didn't have, her grandmother couldn't have, that Nsuta has managed to steal for her own, but she's paying the price of being a pariah and also being called a witch, you know. But it's that place that they are all walking towards a place, that wonderful place of fulfillment. The migrant is that being accepted, you know. But in my novels, it's that that search for equality, or that desire to shake off a curse, you know. And that, in a way, is not so different from the whole colonial baggage that we carry with us. The idea that when they first met us, they questioned our humanity, that they questioned our intelligence, our culture, but also our history. And so we are always carrying this burden with us of, first of all, of convincing ourselves, of reminding ourselves. Perhaps we've convinced ourselves, perhaps we know ourselves, but often they make us doubt. Okay. And we need to remind ourselves that we are, or we are, and we are enough. What we are is enough and is valid. And but also that idea, for me as an author, that I can write, I can have the privilege of writing without reacting to the West. That my literature stops being reactionary, because every time I react to them, I validate them. Yeah, I bring them into my world. And I would like to write the way they write their world, you know, without this double vision having to look that way and look that way. Because you know what? There's so much going in within my world, within Africa, that I need to talk about. But I it's as if I must again make sure that they are not, you know, how can I leave them out? Because they have described me in such a way that I am either pre-colonial, colonial, post-colonial. Yeah. So how do I leave them out? And I'm just me. I'm Ugandan. I'm just African. I'm just me.
Writing for the pleasure of it and for the joy of it.
Absolutely. Whether it's taking on the African patriarchy, fine. But I'm not looking around at them. I'm just me, you know? So when I look at the themes or what my characters are doing, but also what I as an author am doing, we, all the three entities, we are walking towards that self-realization that we are enough, that we are complete, that nobody defines us.
I've been talking about how moisturized I've been through our conversation, but now I'm immersed in shea butter. Final question. I asked you to pick a book or a list of books, if you prefer, that you will recommend to readers who wish to explore more of the Ugandan literary landscape, paired with a song that conveys your perception.
Okay. And that was... I decided to go for a list of books. You dare say a list of books?
You read my mind, because I was like, it wouldn't be presumptive to ask for a list. So thank you.
Thank you very much. You'd never give an offer this room to say whatever. So the first book I went for was Gorit Chomhenda's Waiting. It's set in the Ugandan 1979 war, getting rid of Idi Amin. So parts of the country were liberated first. And where Goretti comes from, that is in the southwest. It took a long time to get there. And so they were still under Idi Amin, but the rest of the country, part of the country has been liberated. And that's a dangerous space to be. So she wrote about that waiting for liberation to arrive. That's the first one. The second one is 100 Days. This is a collection of poems by Julianne Bettec. Now, as you can hear, Julianne is a
Ocot Bettec.
The royal literary clan, the Bettec, and so she too writes poetry, and she also uses the Acholi oral traditions indeed. And 100 Days is set in the Rwanda genocide, but she connects it to what happened among the Acholi during the Koni troubles, and also uses some of her experiences of exile. Then the other one is Flame and Song by Philippa Kabalikagwa. Philippa also comes from royal literary clan, Henry Barlow, one of my favorite poets in Uganda. And she writes this memoir of Uganda, of her life in Uganda in the 60s and 70s, and how her family was kept together through poetry, through music, and how then her life as she started to migrate around Africa. There's The Kingdom of Gravity. That is by Nick McCoha. Nick is also based here in Britain. And he writes again about the war, or Idi Amin's war again. But for him, he's talking about the horrors of the war, but he's also talking about the migration to escape the war and the pain then that comes with that. And finally, is Peter Kagai, The Headline, That Morning and Other Poems. Now, Peter, out of all the people I've mentioned, is the only one based in Uganda.
Mm.
Yes, and Peter is a performer. You know, poetry is supposed to be hard. It's supposed to be performed. So you're better off getting the CD. Yeah, he is a powerful performer. But what Kagai is doing is recording what is going on right now. Because for those of us who have left the country, we tend to write historically. You know, we retrieve those because we are not there. But Kagai is recording what is going on now, and he focuses on love, on politics, on the social norms, on culture, and on disillusionment. He is doing something really exciting, because those are the people who are keeping the Uganda going by being there and entertaining and telling and suggesting and doing, you know, because my novel is going to travel from Britain and arrive, you know, but Kagai is there. He's doing the heavy lifting, you know. And the song is Carry On by Kwan. Now, this is the song that I find myself listening to when I'm down in the dumps.
Hmm.
Yeah. For some reason, it lifts me up. It's not an up-tempo kind of song, but it lifts me up and it tells me, you can do it. You can do it. And because Ugandan writing is not... We are not yet there like you Nigerians. Let me tell you, sometimes I hate you Nigerians. Sometimes I have to say this to you. Sister, every time a shortlist is put out, you have to count the Nigerians and cross them out. And by the time you're done with the Nigerians, there are two left, two spaces left for the rest of the 50 countries. The only reason that I put up with it is that for a long time, Nigerian literature was African literature.
Where is the lie? Nary a lie can be found at all, at all.
So I say, okay, yes, the Wole Soyinka, the Chinua Achebe, and all of them, they carried the torch for Africa for a very long time. So I was Ugandan, but when I was asked about what novels do you know? Yeah, Things Fall Apart. And of course, my uncle, Mwalimu Nguji. And so, yes, but my goodness. Sometimes when I have to recommend books, I have to go back and say, how many of them are Nigerian? Now, good, Jennifer, can you go and look for a book in Zambia, Zimbabwe, and before the Nigerians take over?
It's not our fault. But I do think that we had an unfair advantage that Chinua Achebe was the editor, the advisory editor for Heinemann African Writer Series.
Yeah, true, but also you know what Chinua Achebe said, that when a big goat is reaching up for the larger leaves, the young one is watching. Those institutions did so much because young Nigerians were growing up thinking, I can be Achebe, yeah, I can be Wole Soyinka, yeah, no big deal.
Yeah.
All I had was called Puppy Tech.
Yeah. But you had Tobane Leongo.
I did. But they were not acclaimed around the world the way Achebe. So we studied Nigerian literature.
Ooh.
Yes, I studied Okot Pabitek's songs and the way he writes, and especially explicitly. I attribute that to him. But for a long time, we did a lot of Nigerian literature, and I don't regret it. I enjoyed it.
So the reason I asked that question, because the question was a song that conveys your perception of and your hope for Ugandan literary trajectory. We know that Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria dominates.
Yeah, yeah.
Continental and diaspora African landscape, and it's opening up now. Zimbabwe too. I mustn't forget Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
So, what is your perception of and your hope for the trajectory of Ugandan literary space? And also, if you have any resources that curious people can tap into, where they might be introduced to more works by Ugandan writers.
Okay. Again, I think because we've had more successful poets than authors, than novelists. We have more poets. As you could see, there were more collections of poetry in the books are recommended. So we have a lot of poets, and I'm not worried about that, but I would like for novelists to pick up in Uganda. There are novelists, don't misunderstand me, but most of those novels have only been published in Uganda, and then they publish only one, they're not reissued. So it becomes very hard to recommend them. So those are mainly novels by femwrite, or sometimes novels are self-published and they don't have access to editing, to that fantastic editing and also marketing that someone like me has had. So my hope is that as we dreamt that we could get a few more Ellas, because the writers are there in Uganda, they're there, but what they lack are people who are going to edit them. But also, and perhaps I would hope to have creative writing courses in Uganda. So, and also in Africa, so that we don't have people paying so much money to Western institutions to come out here to study creative writing, you know. And sometimes it's not very helpful. Look how long it took me. So
and replicate Western systems so as well.
My hope is that we get more novelists published and get more novels, but also so a few novels scattered around the ethnicities, because you know I grew up aware of the Igbo, and I was aware of the Fulani, and I was aware of the Yoruba, you know, but I'm in Uganda, and I would like people to know that about us and say, okay, this is Ugandan literature, but this is in Ganda, this is Nyoro, this is Acholi, you know, that kind of thing. So the song of fun was about that. I know you're there, but sometimes you feel like you can't carry on, that you're just hitting against a wall. And so for me, the song was talking to the authors and to the poets in Uganda, just to carry on, that they can do it and they will do it. And we just have to get together and work out which pathways, because mine was Gwavukwani. I can't stop talking about that. That was my pathway. But what kind of pathways would be available for other Ugandans?
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Books and Rhymes. Follow at Books and Rhymes on Twitter and Instagram to stay abreast of conversations on classic and contemporary works by African writers. Until then, please stay safe, take care, and live your best, beautiful, exquisite, and restful lives. All the very best.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.